This is the Venturing Angler Podcast. I'm Tim Harden. In this episode, we're heading north to Alaska to talk about fly fishing at Lava Creek Lodge with Mike Mercer of the Fly Shop in Redding, California. Let's chat with Mike. All right, we're here with Mike Mercer from the Fly Shop in Redding, California to talk about fly fishing in Alaska at Lava Creek Lodge. Mike, thanks for coming back to the Venturing Angler Podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Tim. Glad to do it.
So I've been told you're the person to contact and chat with about Lava Creek Lodge. You've got a soft spot for the place, and I've been hearing a lot about this destination. Let's get started by first identifying where Lava Creek Lodge is located.
Absolutely. So the lodge itself is in one of the most kind of remote regions or corners of Alaska, way out the peninsula that basically, you know, finally comes kind of breaks into pieces into the Aleutian Islands. So it's extremely remote, and that's one of its big appeals. It's just kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's what they call the name of it actually out there. That country is what the natives call where the weather begins. And it's just because, you know, imagine just taking a long, narrow strip of land that points out, you know, Bering Sea on one side, the Pacific on the other side. So this incredible, just wilderness of ocean and this little tiny strip of land that sticks way, way, way out into it. You know, you think about those crazy fishing shows and stuff where the guys are out there catching crabs and stuff like that. But they're out in boats, but this is like a piece of land that actually goes kind of out in where they are. So you can like fly out and land out there in the middle of this crazy country. So yeah, that's
wow,
where it's at.
It's really far out there then. And you really, I imagine as an angler, you feel like you've got the place to yourself.
Yeah. Literally. I mean, there was just so few operators out there because it's difficult to operate out there. It's way out. You've got to bring everything in by plane, and the weather isn't always the best, and there's just no real support infrastructure out there, right? So everyone who operates out there, they're pretty amazing people because they have to get it all done on their own, have to fly everything and, you know, fly boats strapped to the pontoons of their float planes and, you know, somehow find ways to bring queen-size mattresses out. I mean, everything's small planes, right? And so there's no other way. I mean, you can put stuff on a barge and get it out there. And, for example, the owner of Lava Creek Lodge, Phil Bird, when he brought his a lot of his stuff out there, cabin materials to put the cabins together and stuff, he brought them out by barge out to this wild, wild area in a barge that could get close to the shore. And then he brought in a helicopter to helicopter big sling loads of it into where his actual lodge site was. I mean, just crazy stuff, and that's expensive. But crazy stuff to just operate out there.
Wow. And I talked to Phil last week. He was, I think 2 weeks ago, he was getting a barge ready, or maybe 3 weeks ago, and then last week he was getting ready to go up again just to make sure everything's ready for bear hunting season. And so it sounds like it takes quite a bit just to be able to operate there, which says a lot about how special the place is.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I can't overstate how special it is. I mean, Alaska is an amazing country. It's so remote by itself. Most of it's so roadless and off the beaten track. You have to have a plane to get anywhere out there. And for it just seems like some of that country is so pristine. It just, when you go out there, it feels like you're the first person's ever been there. It's just amazing, just crazy remote country, which is such a big draw of that country. And if anything, this area is even more special because it's, so few people do operate out there. For example, you go out there, for a fishing trip, they have some of the best, we'll talk about that, some of the best king and silver fishing in the world out there. But there's other things too, which remind you of where you're at. You can take a day off, for example, and you can go land on a remote Bering Sea beach and creep up over a cliff and see it like 1,000 walrus just all bellowing and moving around on a beach out there just a long ways from anyone. I mean, nobody sees that, right? There's nobody out there to see it. Or you can go beachcomb on that same beach and find Japanese glass balls and crazy cool stuff. Or, you know, there's just so many things out there that are completely untouched by the hand of man, completely unsullied by the hand of man, that, you know, that's getting really hard to find anywhere in the world, even in Alaska. And so, yeah, you go there for the fishing, but there's more than that. And having been going to Alaska for the better part of 40 years now, I understand how rare it is to see stuff like that. And a lot of it was like that 35 years ago when I started going up there, but anymore it's rare. And so I'm really excited about that, because that stuff, it's not just the amazing fishing. It's like something happens in your soul when you see that country and you're in it. And it's like, whoa, this is amazing. This is something I'll never, ever forget being here. So yeah, it's special.
Wow. And one of the things you mentioned there is that there are even places in Alaska where, you know, things have gotten a little crowded. And one of my intros into the reality of Alaska was when I was a youngster, about 20 years ago, maybe. I got a job at a fishing lodge in Alaska. And what I imagined was, you know, a fantasy about being in the wilderness and, you know, having to make sure that, you know, I was carrying a gun in case a grizzly bear came and there's going to be these magnificent runs of salmon. But it turned out someone in the industry who I knew at the time said, you know, you might not want to take that job. It turned out it wasn't going to be that way at all. It was going to be crowded. I was going to be guiding people next to other anglers who weren't from the operation, who, you know, for pretty spawned out fish. And so, you know, when I'm looking at Alaska operations, you know, hearing about how truly, you know, remote or how much of a wilderness the place is always something that probably gets my attention first. And I've, you know, just sounds about as remote and far out as it gets.
Yeah, that's a fact. It really is. I mean, you get out there, just indications. I remember the first time I flew out there and we were flying from one of the lodges. It actually is older lodge, and we're flying out and we're going down out the peninsula and of course on the left is basically the Pacific Range, is the enormous, really imposing mountains that you don't fly through at very many places because it's too dangerous. So that was on our left. We're going down the peninsula, and underneath us was these big giant old volcanic flows and cinder blows, stuff like that. And you look down and you see wolves, and even Alaska, you see bears a lot of places, but wolves you don't see that much, really. So that was like an indication to me, like, okay, we're out here. And the wolves didn't even look up. You know, it's like they don't think they hear a lot of planes out there because they didn't even look up hardly. They just kept doing what they're doing. And we'd see moose in some of the willow glades. And then on the right going down was the ocean, right? And just a short little kind of estuary plain, just open plain between the giant mountains and the ocean. And you're just like, wow, this is amazing out here. And, you know, you would land at the river and bears would come walking over and kind of looking at you and like, what are you? Wow. And, you know, and you just, you know, there's one little like 10 house village out there stuck in the middle of nowhere. And you wonder, how do these people survive? And I mean, that's not even near the lodge or anything, but you know, you fly over it and think, how can you survive out there? There's no other support. And so it's just, you realize, you know, you're not in Kansas anymore when you're out there. It's just, there's so much that is, that's unfamiliar to us in our comfortable worlds with, you know, instant gratification, things we need to be comfortable, all these things out there, that's all stripped away. And so the you know, we do have the comforts of home in many respects, and this comfortable lodge feels built and everything, but you walk out of your cabin at night and it's like, whoa. I mean, you see every star. It's like the whole sky is a Milky Way sometimes. And you know, you may hear wolves howling or bears grunting and off in the darkness somewhere. And you know, it's, you got this wild river that comes out of the big mountains and goes 10 miles into the ocean in front of you. And you just know no one, I mean, there's certainly no one walking around out there, and there's no one you know, that there's no roads or anything. So you're just out there. And so it's very special. And like some of the places, like the place you mentioned, where sometimes, yeah, they can get a little crowded in the most popular fishing places in Alaska. Not all of them, certainly, but some of them. And there's certainly no indication of that here. And I don't think there will be for a long, long time, which is, you know, for a guy like me who's always looking for the next new, really cool place in Alaska, this was like an unexpected goldmine. I didn't really think that there was going to be anything like this. And especially with some of the species we're fishing for, like kings and stuff. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of the fish, you mentioned the ocean being right there. I imagine these are not, you know, gnarly, moldy, spawned out fish. Let's talk about these fish. What are the fish like, and then what is the fishing like?
So you're right. I mean, as I mentioned, there's a narrow little kind of a strip of land between the big mountains where these creeks come out of, where these streams, rivers come out of. And it's funny because they come out of the mountains usually pretty small. And then those relatively few miles, they get a fair amount bigger before they hit the ocean. And so they're not that long of rivers. The salmon don't have to go very far at all. We're talking a few miles. And so, yes, when we are fishing for these king salmon, chum salmon, silver salmon, they are mint bright. When they come in, it's unusual to get fish that either don't have sea lice actively on them or don't have the marks from sea lice, you know, from having just shed them. And because we fish the lower miles of these rivers, these fish are chrome bright. I mean, you see something like with king salmon, the scientists will tell you that some kings come in a little colored up, a little blushed up. When the second they hit fresh water, they're already a little blushed. So you do see some of those little blush fish, but no, these are not red salmon. These are anywhere from chrome to a little bit of blush, whether it be kings or silvers, chums. Chums, of course, come in, their coloration is different and they color up quickly. But with the kings and the silvers, they are just as bright as can be. And they're big, which is not unusual for the peninsula. The king salmon out there are normal size for Alaska king salmon. They average about 25 pounds. A big one's 40, a small one's 15. But you get a lot of fish in the 20 to 30 pound range. And once in a while, you get a big giant one. But the most astounding thing is the numbers. I mean, a lot of places in Alaska, you go and fish, you work really hard throwing fast, fast sinking lines and deep runs to get, like steelhead, to get one a day, you know, one really good fish a day. Two would be a great banner day. Up there, you do better. There's just more fish. And silvers, like silvers come in huge numbers, and they're big fish. Lots and lots of fish in that 10 to 15 pound range, and some bigger. And so, you know, it's kind of like the best of all worlds. You get this crazy remote area, no one else coming in on you because it's too far out. Nobody, if you don't have a lodge there, like Phil does, you can't get there. It doesn't make sense. It costs too much avgas to get there in a plane. So you've got it all to yourself, and you've just got these floods of big fish coming on every new tide, just coming in. And you go down and you see this chaotic scene sometimes where there's big kings coming up in shallow water, rooster tailing, and you know, big seals coming in behind them, and gulls wheeling and diving and screeching, and bears on the banks. And I mean, it's nuts. Just, and again, untouched man. And so to get that quality of fish in that scenario is just amazing. And so whether you're a king guy that likes to come in and catch, you know, good numbers of kings, and the neat thing about kings there is that they're in pretty shallow water, or a silver guy, which just likes numbers of big fish, and Phil's got that in spades. You know, it's just a untouched, amazing fishery. So certainly some of the best of its kind left in Alaska.
That's great. And what I've even heard, I was talking to Justin Miller last week and I talked to Phil too. Even the chums come in, they're so bright that they're hardly, you know, to an untrained eye, it's hard to even identify them as chums.
Yeah, it's true. When they first come in, I mean, for the first couple of days, they look kind of like the silver, you know, they just like, oh, I guess early silver. And it's like, oh, wait. You turn them just right in the light and you see those very, very faint little bars on the side. But if you're not paying attention, yeah, they don't look like chums. So yeah, that's true.
Wow. And then there are dollies and any other species in these waters?
There are dollies. And so one of the things about Phil's program is that weather permitting, you can fly out a time or two during the week. And so in addition to the home water, which is just amazing, you've got several other rivers that you can fish, you can fly to and fish. And they're all gray. I mean, there's not really that much difference between them. They all load up with fish. And so one of the species that you do get, of course, in addition to all the salmon, which is the big draw, is that he has creeks that have a lot of dollies that come in. And I mean, lots. And they're relatively small waters, most of them. So they're really fun for guys that want to go and walk and wade for a day. They just put the salmon aside for one day, fly to a little creek somewhere, and just catch a bunch of dollies. Just really fun stuff on a 5 or 6 wade. Nice fish, you know, typical lot of them, you know, 18, 20 inches, but some up mid-20s, pushing 30 even. And so some beautiful fish. And it's just a real great way to have a change of pace from the salmon. And a lot of guys don't do it, but the guys that do never regret it. And there's also rainbows. And, you know, we don't sell as a rainbow fishery, but because there's not big numbers, you can't really go there and just say, okay, let's catch a bunch of rainbows today. It's not like that. But if you go to the dolly places where you catch dolly, there are also really nice rainbows there. And what we find is that the guys who want to walk, who can cover ground, they're rewarded with the rainbows, because dollies are everywhere, but rainbows are scattered throughout them like little Easter eggs, a little pool here, a little pool there. And they're nice rainbows. They're good, big, like Bristol Bay size rainbows. But there's not a lot of them, but they're there. And so again, we've got a few guys that just love that kind of fishing. So they'll do the salmon stuff, but they'll take one, maybe 2 days and just fish dollies and rainbows and just love it. So pretty cool.
That is cool. Now, when we were talking about the salmon, you mentioned a lot of shallow water. I've noticed on the website and in social media and elsewhere that I see a lot of two-handed rods. What is the style of fishing generally like? Or is there no general style of fishing? You know, how are you guys going after these fish?
So, yeah, it depends on the species, of course. But for kings, the water up there is tends to be shallow. I mean, it's the bottom is sand. They're sand bottoms, so they're extremely easy to wade. And they're like shifting sand. And the runs do change a bit from year to year because of that. One of the rivers has black sand in particular, and it's really unusual to wade in there. And just the sand's always moving at your feet. It's odd. You look down, and it's like the whole bottom's moving. But it's shallow, and although a couple of the rivers are very wide, one of them in particular is, I don't know, 150 yards wide. It's very wide, but you could find spots to wade across it without getting your knees wet. I mean, it's very unusual. And you know, a lot of this is all from lava flows and sand that's coming out of big lava activity up in the mountains. And so it's just constantly changing like that. And because of that, the runs tend to be much shallower than you usually look for in king rivers. So a typical king scenario might be fishing a run that's 10, 12 feet deep, fishing a high-speed ID, something really, really fast, a lot of T20, stuff like that to get you down in these runs with a double-handed rod. Certainly, almost everyone's fishing double-handed rods there, except me. I'm still an old single-handed dinosaur. But you don't need that real heavy sinking line. I mean, as an example, some of the runs I fish, although, I fish relatively fast sinking dips. There was days I'd be in a run, and one of two scenarios would happen. A, the run just was shallow enough I could see the fish lying out there. Maybe the water was only 4 feet deep, and there'd be a bunch of kings and chums lying out there. And these are cromers, you know, sea lice fish. These aren't old spawning fish. These are the most, you know, desirable fish you can imagine. Or the run would be deeper, maybe 6 feet deep, and a little enough of a glacial color that I couldn't see the bottom, but I'd see fish wafting up in the current. So you could tell there was a bunch of them in these old runs, because the fish would just like get pushed up in the water column, and you could swing through them midway through the water column, not dredging, and the kings would eat. In my experience, that's very unusual. Usually what kings, you know, you've got to dredge, and then you'll do well. These fish, I could have been fishing an intermediate line and it caught them. So that's really unusual. And as far as the tackle goes, again, you know, 9 weight is the classic rod for up there, whether it be a single or double. And like usually T11, which we're spey fishing, the T11's fine. T14 maybe. You don't need, and you don't need very long piece of it. Single hand rods, I was using a 25-foot sink tip, a 200 grain to 250 grain. So not really extreme tackle at all. It's swing fishing. The kings are the classic swing fishing. You're usually making 50, 60-foot cast, mending once, let it swing through. The water's not that fast. It's fast enough to justify the sinking lines I mentioned, but a lot of times you're casting down and across, almost like for steelhead, and just getting the prime part of the swing, and before it bunches out in the slower water below you. So it's just classic tight line swing fishing. You get the big grabs. It's so perfect. It's like you have a pinch yourself. Like, really? I don't have to use the really fast sinking lines, or I don't have to wade up to my chest to make these crazy casts. I don't have to have a spey rod that I can boom out 100 feet. It's like, nah. None of that. It's fine spey fishing, but you don't have to do any of the really hard or less desirable stuff that you find so many places in the king world. And silver fishing is classic. It's 8-weight stuff. It's floating line only. It's fishing poppers on top. And typically, you'll see anywhere in Alaska, some of the streams you fish up there, some of the rivers you fish, are the fishing more, seems more conducive to popper fishing. Fishing pink polywogs. They'll eat those everywhere, but some rivers, they just consistently are on them. Other rivers, they'll eat them, but it's better streamer fishing. So that's really typical Alaskan. Whether it be extreme conditions, weather conditions, whether it be the stream, for whatever reason, one stream just fishes better with poppers than another. I've seen that over the years so many times, and this is the same. And you've got numerous rivers to fish, so because of that, if you say, I really want a day popper fishing, well, it doesn't mean you can pull it out of a hat because of weather conditions might not warrant it that day. But there are places you can go that will be more likely to see that. I want to catch like 50 silvers today, big silvers. Where do we go? Well, that's, again, because they all have that. But again, it's just 8-weight floating line, streamers or poppers. It's just kind of like as good as you can get. I like the fact too that you can move around and see some different water. If the weather's bad, you might be stuck on a home river all week. That's unusual, but I mean, worst case scenario, that can happen, and that's not a bad scenario. There's even a place you can walk to from the lodge if you want to, and most people don't, but I mean, just to give you an idea, there's just places, there's so many options up there. Particularly assuming the weather will allow you to fly. So.
And are the seasons pretty standard for salmon fishing in Alaska?
It really is. Yeah, it's early June to middle of July for the kings, and then silvers like the third week to middle August to the end of September. So these 5 or 6 week seasons for each species. And then conveniently right in the middle is the prime chum season, what Phil calls his grand slam season. And so that's fun. Phil charges less money for it. You still get amazing experience, just different species. That does happen to be some of the best dolly in what rainbow fishing has. That does happen in that grand slam season. You get it other times, but that's like the best of it. So that's kind of convenient. Like, all right, more better species during the middle season between kings and silvers. It really is, begins earlier June, ends the end of September.
And earlier in the podcast, you mentioned, you can see walruses and you've mentioned wolves. What critters might, people expect to see? And, I saw something recently that the fly shop now has, or the fly shop was announcing, on behalf of Lava Creek Lodge, family trips. What's available in those areas?
Yeah, absolutely. So the animals you tend to see out there, very often from the plains, but sometimes on the ground too, are bears, wolves, moose, sometimes caribou. Not so glamorous, so to speak, things like minks and beavers and little critters like that. But there's you know, plenty of the bigger species too, and sometimes they'll come near the lodge, but often they'll be out in other rivers. You'll see them flying, or after you come down, they'll wander around you. You have foxes, things like that, but you'll see on the rivers. So that's just kind of a gimme. That's always, those critters, those animals are always around. And so, yeah, it's a big bonus, because you get to see, yeah, this is unsullied, this is untouched country out here. They're not getting just shot all the time, or, you know, bothered by people and planes constantly. They're pretty happy, so to speak. And then as far as like non-fishing things or family things, when we went out there, we were so blown away by the fishing. We were just like zeroed in on that for the first couple of years, and just like developing that, understanding that, getting the lodge, you know, a nice lodge in place, getting everything going. And once we kind of had that, we started realizing, we just, you know, Phil would offhandedly drop a little thing, little remark about, oh, you know, the walrus, or, you know, the little lake up there, you know, and we'd look around and see, where'd you get all these glass balls, Phil, you know, or things like that. So we started talking to him. I was like, well, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to do out there. So, you know, we have a family, especially during the Grand Slam season, because that's the time when we normally do the family trips. If you can go out and one day he'll fly over to the coast, which is like 10 minutes. It's just right there. And you've got these long, long, long beaches. He might put you down on one end of it with your family, and then he'd fly down to the other end of it, hundreds and hundreds of yards down, and you'll walk the beach with your guide, and maybe you'll go to, you know, where the walrus are and look at them first, or just do a, you know, half a day of beach combing, that sort of thing. And I mean, it's crazy the stuff you find out there, because no one's up to beach combing, and like I said, the glass balls are the big find, and they're not that unusual. And you also see things have come off of ships for years and years, sometimes parts of ships, crazy dead things out there, you know, parts of whales and, you know, just fish you don't even know what they are. And you just never know what you're going to find out there. And then you get to the other end and, you know, he'll pick you up. Maybe they have a fire going for you, and bring you back to the lodge. Or, you know, sometimes they'll bring people over. There's a volcano nearby, and there's a lake, right? And there's a dormant volcano, and there's a lake in it. And so he can land the float plane right in the lake, and you can have lunch there down in the volcano.
Wow.
So, I mean, just really super special things. I mean, the more we start realizing what's there, it just reminds us that, yeah, the fishing's world-class, but it's a bigger picture. It's the country is world-class. And then the more we go out there and we just sate ourselves on fish, it's like, all right, but, you know, today I think I'm going to take the day off. I'm going to go beach comb. You know, words I never thought I'd hear coming out of my mouth. And some of the best salmon fishing in the world, and I'm going to take a day off and go beach combing. It's like, that's never going to happen. But once you've been up there for a few years and start understanding it, and again, kind of sate yourself on it, you know, all right, I've caught lots of fish. You realize that, man, I want to see a little bit more of this country, because a lot of that kind of country in the world is gone. It's never going to come back. And so this is an opportunity to see something that, you know, your great, 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 great grandfather would have seen and just thought was normal. But as the world's become such a small place, now we realize, no, this was normal a long time ago, but now it's like a little glimpse of, you know, the just country the way God made it, which is so rare anymore.
Yeah. We've identified, you know, how far off the grid this is. That might raise questions for people about how to get there. And you gave us a little bit of a taste of that with the float plane trip in. But generally, coming from the lower 48, how does one get up to Love Creek Lodge?
Yeah, it's actually pretty painless, which is amazing for being so remote. What you'll do is you'll take a commercial jet from wherever you are in the lower 48 to Anchorage. You'll overnight in Anchorage. And if you've never been up there, it's kind of fun to stay at a place like the Lakefront Anchorage Hotel, because you walk into this place and there's this big, open, sprawling lobby, and it's got all, you know, every stuffed animal that's known to man in Alaska, grizzly bears and moose and caribou, and everything's in there. So it's quite an introduction. It's like, whoa. And so you get in there, and it's a fun place to spend a night. And they've got their own restaurant and everything if you don't want to, you know, wander out or anything. But you can stay there overnight. And then the next morning, the beauty of the whole program is Phil has arranged for a private charter flight directly from Anchorage to the launch. So you don't have to worry about flying into some little village in the middle of nowhere and maybe overnight or changing planes and, you know, just more stuff to go wrong. You just get on a plane in Anchorage and you get off at his launch. And so that's been a great decision he made, I think, early on. It's like, let's just do this. And so it's painless. You know, you just have to get to Anchorage the day before, overnight, and you're good to go.
It sounds like you get quite the tour and the views on the way in, huh?
Yeah, you do, because you go, you head out the peninsula, and you quickly lose every. I mean, there's not much up there to start with, but you know, for a while, you're seeing commercial netters in the inlet, and you'll see little remote villages tucked away here and there, of course, roadless. And then the farther you go, it's a couple hours out there, a couple hour flight. The farther you go, you just start shedding things. You start shedding any signs of civilization. And the last, 45 minutes or so of it is 30 minutes is nothing. And so then it's like, okay, I'm really going somewhere. So yeah, it's pretty special.
It sounds special. It sounds amazing. With the lodge being so far out, and it sounds like it's right on the water, what are the accommodations like?
Very comfortable. Phil has brought out cabins, built, constructed cabins, pre-made cabins on site. They're very comfortable. They're roomy little cabins. They're cozy. They have full bathroom, showers, everything. Very comfortable, brand new beds. They're nicely appointed, so they're great. Each has a porch, so you can sit on the porch or hang your waders underneath the porch overhang if you want. So they're well thought out. And he's got the main lodge building, which is just a few steps away, that where you take your meals. It's comfortable. It's not a big operation. It only takes 8 people, but each 2 anglers have their own private cabin, and it's all you could want. Very, very comfortable for where you're at. It's amazingly comfortable and just very, very nice.
And then there's a main lodge separate from the cabins?
There is, yeah. It's just a main lodge. It was originally, like everything out there, was originally a weatherport or a tent. And then he basically used that frame and built a lodge around it. So now he's got a nice lodge to go in and eat meals at and sit around on couches and talk, have hors d'oeuvres, have a drink. It's really comfortable, nice communal meeting area. And yeah, people love it.
And you mentioned the drinks. What's the food like there?
The food's excellent. Phil has a habit of getting excellent chefs. He's got the same gal that's coming back again, was there last year, and she was a huge hit. Phil, early on, his food was always great. Great camp fare, great lodge fare, just what you think. He decided at one point, I'm going to step this up. And so he brought in a very qualified chef, and she's amazing. Her food is better than average, that's for sure. So people are always surprised at how great the food is. And it fits that country, big steaks and halibut and just what you'd expect for a great lodge in the middle of nowhere, Alaska.
Great. Awesome. For those who want to learn more, check out Lava Creek Lodge on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Lava Creek Lodge. And then on the flyshop.com, they've got a page for Lava Creek Lodge, which you can find pretty easily through Google, too, if you search Lava Creek Lodge. Mike, this sounds pretty exciting. I appreciate the conversation. I've got to get out there. It sounds pretty exciting. And
yeah, you got to do it.
it sounds exactly like what you could – what you would dream of for a trip to Alaska and more with all those other activities. And so I appreciate learning more and appreciate the conversation, and thanks for coming on again.
You bet. So great. Good to talk.